doesn't seem possible, but over 50 years ago, I was the announcer on the original radio program called The Shadow.
They had this radio program called Detective Story Hour, which was a story out of a detective story. And just as a gimmick, they used as they called the announcer The Shadow.
I worked with three shadows, Orson Welles and John Stone and Fred Morrison.
You know, sometimes the scripts were so complicated that when I finished, I wasn't really sure, you know, what had happened. Actually, not always, but because we weren't there that much.
You were thinking about what the heck he was laughing at.
He was unseen, invisible, the perfect embodiment of the radio and pulp hero. A creation that could only have succeeded in the media of the imagination. He was the Shadow.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows.
For nearly six decades now, that disembodied voice, with its mocking, sinister, haunting laugh, has stirred the imaginations of millions of radio listeners from Maine to California. The Shadow endures today as the dominant symbol of mystery drama during radio's golden age in the 30s, 40s, and early 1950s.
2 years ago, I was in the hospital for an operation, and the resident doctor, a young resident, came running up to my room to meet me because he knew that I had been associated with The Shadow, which everybody knows. I mean, they may not have heard anything else about radio, but everybody knows The Shadow.
It could never have succeeded in television. It was the marvelous thing of what people conjured up in their minds. And they could see The Shadow, and they could see Margot and so forth. I think it would have been a terribly dull television program.
What creative forces molded The Shadow's tremendous popularity? Why, after nearly 60 years, is the program not only remembered fondly, but still being aired on many radio stations across the nation? Who were the people that shaped the character's success? We'll take an in-depth look behind the scenes of one of radio's most popular programs. We'll talk with the people who helped make it all happen. And we'll illustrate their comments with excerpts from the programs they helped create. The Shadow's origins date back to 1929. McFadden Publishing had begun utilizing an emerging medium, radio, to boost the sales of their True Detective magazine. Now, their publishing competitors, Stroot and Smith, took a hard look at the new medium with a view toward stemming the McFadden tide that seemed to be sweeping away the readership of their own Detective Story magazine. McFadden's success was particularly galling to Street and Smith. After all, it was Street and Smith that had first developed the popular detective magazine format when they transformed the old Nick Carter magazine into Detective Story. Detective Story had spawned a host of imitators, and it was now one of these, True Detective, that was challenging Street & Smith's preeminence in the field. Street & Smith's advertising agency, Retroff and Ryan, conceived the idea of a weekly radio mystery anthology dramatizing material drawn from the current issue of Detective Story magazine. The scriptwriter, who was to adapt the magazine material to a radio format, a young man named Harry Charlot, suggested that the host announcer for the new series be a mysterious-sounding character who would speak through a filter microphone. He was to be called The Shadow.
The Shadow knows.
Street and Smith's Detective Story Magazine Hour made its debut over CBS on July 31st, 1930, with The Shadow as host. But, as sometimes happens, the shadow gimmick quickly became a case of a tail wagging the dog. Stories from the magazine, even the name of the magazine, were quickly forgotten. But the shadow, as narrator, became a veritable media sensation. As one reviewer of the day put it, the shadow announcing the Street and Smith detective stories waxes more melodramatic than the characters themselves in the skit presented. And a few months later, while the True Detective stories beat Street and Smith to the air with the dramatization of its mag stories, the latter firm does its best to make its program creepy, starting at the announcements by the shadow, who delivers in low register, hissing and growling in villainous fashion. Announcer Ken Roberts was involved with the shadow almost from the beginning.
I had come to CBS as a very, very young man in early 1931. And I announced many different kinds of programs, of course. But one day, fortune smiled upon me, and I was asked to come on to a program which was fairly new at that time. It had been on the air, I believe, a year or maybe less, a program called The Shadow. I was not the first announcer, but I did come on to the program in 1931. At which time, the Shadow was nothing like what it was in later years when it featured Lamont Cranston. When I came on to the show, The Shadow was a series of dramatic crime programs solved by different detectives every week. The role of The Shadow on that program was to introduce it and to act as something of a narrator. And once he had done his opening line, he was practically finished on the program until the very end of the show, when he came back with "The weed of crime bears bitter fruit, crime does not pay, the shadow knows." What went on in between his two appearances on the program, of course, was a, as I said before, a crime program, or a detective story, things of that sort. And the man who read the lines that I referred to before, concluding with "the shadow knows," was a gentleman by the name of Jimmy Licurta.
Shadow historian Anthony Tolan.
Licurta was very much in the Valentino mold. He was a Broadway actor, Latin lover type. Dorothy Randall Reddick, The Estranged Life of Frank Reddick, commented that if you walked down the street with Jimmy, women's heads turned when he walked by. He had that kind of charisma. Unfortunately, or actually fortunately for the character, Licurta's ambitions were aimed at Broadway.
Jimmy left for another job of some sort, or perhaps another assignment. In any case, he did leave the show, and he was replaced by a gentleman who played the part for 3 to 5 years after that, Frank Reddick. And Frank, of course, is one of the best actors in radio. He had appeared on almost all the shows that were on the air at that time. And he took on the assignment.
The weed of crime bears bitter fruit. Crime does not pay. The shadow knows.
This was years before Raymond would host Inner Sanctum. It was before The Man in Black on Suspense, or The Mysterious Traveler, or The Whistler. And all of those, I'm sure, were patterned after The Shadow, after Frank Reddick. And I think you have to realize also, I mean, the radio station, CBS especially, had discovered the advantages of having mysterious on-the-air personages. The Silver Mask Tenor of the Air was very popular until he unmasked himself, and his career was never the same after that. The same year, I think, 1930, Arthur Tracy began as a street singer, and for a long time there was a secrecy about who the street singer was. There was a build-up. And it was natural to do this on a show like Detective Story Magazine. It just had not been done before, and audiences had heard these announcers with these wonderful smooth voices and singers on the air, but they had never heard a voice singer of the air, like Frank Reddick as The Shadow. One reader wrote into the Detective Story Magazine and told about how his dog started howling whenever The Shadow spoke on the air. I mean, this was a voice that over those early radio sets, remember, I mean, the staticky sounds of that, but the harsh voice came over. People listened.
People listened indeed. But when they went rushing to their neighborhood newsstands, it was the Shadow magazine that they clamored for, not Detective Story. Sprint and Smith, potential hit on their hands, but no product to sell. The Shadow magazine did not yet exist.
I was an editor up at McFadden's. I edited True Strange Stories. That was how I was getting into the magazine business. And that was why Blackwell wanted me to write The Shadow, because he knew that I'd edited a weird magazine with True Strange Stories, and that I was also a newspaper writer and could write fast, and he said, go ahead and write something in this thing.
Stephen Smith hired Walter Gibson, a former magician and newspaper writer, to develop the Shadow character into a saleable product. He spoke with Gibson recently on the occasion of his 87th birthday.
After The Shadow began to go, all the other competition magazines simply said, oh, write something, let's get up a name, something like The Shadow, let's get in there all doing that. And just as they've had Thrilling Love Story, Popular Love Story, The Dime Love Story, everything of that sort, they all copied the different things, and that was the going of it. So that spring all followed in, so you naturally expected them to write the same type of stuff. The Phantom was the first, then came the Spider, then came things like Operator 5, Secret Agent X, Dr. Wu-Fan. The last one of the lot was the Green Llama.
In order to establish their ownership of the Shadow character as something more than merely the host of a radio mystery program, in April 1931, Sprint and Smith published the first issue of the Shadow magazine. No longer was the Shadow just a disembodied voice. He was now a sinister crusader against crime, with adventures all his own. Gibson had created a whole cast of magazine characters, agents who would help the Shadow in his fight against evil. Initial plans were to publish the Shadow magazine quarterly, but when the first issue sold out, and the second issue, after a double press run, sold out too, Street and Smith changed their plans. By its third issue, the Shadow magazine became a monthly, and 11 months after that, it went to twice a month. In the summer of 1931, the first of 6 2-reel Shadow motion picture shorts was released to theaters.
I would knock off 30 to 40 pages I could a day. The pages were 250 words, and there were 200 pages for a story. That meant in 5 days, if I did 40 pages a day, I'd have my writing done. If I did only 30, that meant 6, really 7 days. And I frequently would do that. Our idea was to make something that sold. And we liked this particular thing. Blackwell laid it out very well to me. He said, you give them these things in the magazine and find out what they like. And he said, they like meat, and they like potatoes, and they like a couple of other things, and you start giving them these. Well, pretty soon you say, hey, these people, we better give them a bit more of a variety. Let's give them some carrots and some spinach, and you come up with these wonderful things. And he said, what do you find out? You find out that they like potatoes. For God's sake, give them potatoes. Now, the old school stayed with that, but what my contribution to it, to which Manavik was responsible to a marked degree, because he went along with me and therefore would even come up with suggestions. Ours was to draw away from that and not just make them a stereotype, but we did realize that a lot of the readers were stereotyped. The readers were expecting a certain similarity. So I kept things like the Shadow Sanctum, but I built in these things and began adding to them. So these new things, and they liked it. And I don't think they've ever done anything like that before.
Walter Gibson, under the pen name of Maxwell Grant, wrote 282 Shadow novels, in addition to his 117 books on magic, games, and other subjects. Gibson got inspiration for many of his plots from his travels. One of these, Grove of Doom, was inspired by a casual remark by Strait & Smith's general manager, Bill Ralston. Ralston complained to Gibson about consistently losing his golf balls in a grove of trees adjacent to the golf course he frequented.
Ralston told about how they'd been playing golf and the golf balls would go in this woods. And they go in there and look for them. And when you got under these copper beeches, you would see this weird light because of the result. Well, I was familiar with the same thing because I'd go camping up in Canada. And when you go carrying those loads on a portage, every now and then you'd hit a chunk of maple wood. You're suddenly out of the green woods and you were just maple woods and you got that same strange or different lighting effect. So this grove, I used that to call it the Grove of Doom. So I had two families that were having arguments about each other, and they lived on different hillsides, and in between was a valley, and there was this grove. So somebody got the idea of knocking somebody off when he got in that grove. So murders began to happen in the grove. And Chinese became involved in the story and things of that sort. Well, these people were found dead one after another in the grove. Well, it turned out that Kun Moon was a python from the snake temple in Penang, and he had been brought over and put in that grove just to take human victims as they came through, and he was the murderer. And well, that, of course, the scene led to Chinatown when they were trying to find a local murderer and things of that sort. The Black Hush predicted the blackout of many years later. What the Black Hush was, these crooks had devised a flashlight, or searchlight, a huge searchlight, but it shot blackness instead of light. So all they would do would be set this on top of a building and take a bank or something across the way and hit that with a smack, and with all the electricity would go out in the bank, and would come the crooks and do the stuff. Well, every time the shadow would go and try to get him, they'd nail him. And one thing that they were very strong in, they had a place out in the country. All you had to do was fly over it with a plane. And bang, they just turned on the black hush for the black light. And they killed all the electric work in the plane and you were done. So to attack them by plane was the worst thing you could do. You were stuck. Well, the shadow flew over in his autogyro. Well, now you know the autogyro is the way they worked. That big window on top was not a motor. It was like a room. And all you did was cut off your motor, and that the faster you came down, the faster it went, and the more it stopped you, like a parachute. So the shadow simply flew around until he knew he got the place, because all of a sudden, bang, and all his electricity is cut out, and he says, "This is what I wanted," and he lands right on that damn place, because he just coasted down into it. And he didn't need any power, and that was when he came and finished him. Well, I had stories like that, and those were, we played those very strongly. In Florida, there was a lake called Orange Lake. And Orange Lake is about 10 miles long, and it runs from one county to another. And it has floating islands. Now, the reason these islands float is the lake is fairly shallow, and it has at the bottom a lot of water lilies that keep coming up, and every now and then they get so strong that they come up and bring up a mass of mud with them. Well, birds drop seeds on the muds and other things grow, and gradually islands begin, these floating islands, and they're bigger than this room and solid, and trees grow on them. And I'd checked that through a guidebook, but I had a good scene that they're after this guy and he keeps stalling off the sheriff. And he has this remote shack on this lake that nobody's paying any attention to. And when he goes there, the sheriff comes there the next morning to nail him, and there ain't no shack, because the shack is still 10 miles down the lake, is now another county. So I put all these things in. The one I think you'd get the most kick out of was where I had an institution, and one university had it, where they were studying apes. Gorillas and things, and kept them there. And they had some pretty tough keepers at the place, so I got the idea of the keepers being guys that had been in jail. When they get out of jail, the other people would get them. And then, you know the story? They would go on robbing, And I had two wonderful things. They'd be flying around with a truckload of gorillas or various types of monkeys. And if they were going west, they were taking them to Sarasota for the circus. If they're going east, then they're taking them to the jungle gardens at Miami. So they had perfect alibis. I knew all this stuff from living down there. My father-in-law at the time owned an orange grove. And I get over to New Orleans and get things over there and come in with all this stuff. But these people didn't realize, they don't seem to realize that. They'd think I was spending my time down in the village or doing some other crazy thing.
He asked Gibson whether the shadow plots were ever intentionally topical.
Tremendously topical. Extremely so. And earlier, that was one of the troubles of the war. We couldn't make him topical then. I had to stop the topical stuff because the things were going on in real life and on a much bigger scale. And earlier, I had him tied in with things like the League of Nations and things of that sort. And not only that, but we were cut down. This is a thing the jerks can't get through their heads. The reason that I went to whodunit stories was our magazine had taken on the format of a whodunit. So I began going into the whodunit stories during the war. And one guy wrote, oh, Gibson was getting tired. In other words, he thought these stories sounded tired. Well, I think he was getting tired of reading anything except what he wanted to read. I mean, it was one of those things that was silly. I was simply going by what Manabek and others thought were the trends.
Meanwhile, back at the offices of Street and Smith, the editors of the company's other publications were complaining. Virtually the entire corporate advertising budget was being spent to promote the Shadow magazine, and they were beginning to feel like stepchildren. Manager Ralston capitulated, with a strange result.
It was shifting to Love Story magazine, and they kept the Shadow as an announcer on Love Story. I don't know whether anybody's kept those scripts, but for 40 weeks, there were 40 weeks of love, and the Shadow was the announcer because Ralston, as a good business manager, said, well, we identify the Shadow with Street and Smith, and Love Story is also published by Street and Smith, so keep the announcer, don't get rid of him.
And so, incongruous as it may have sounded, the Shadow became host of Love Story dramas. One reviewer bemoaned the Shadow's being transplanted to the Love Story Hour. What a loss to fandom when the Shadow tottered from his underworld throne to those Street and Smith love stories, he wrote. Concurrent with his love story activities, the Shadow served a brief stint as mystery host on CBS, and later in 1932 moved to NBC for his own program, finally called The Shadow. He later returned to CBS. The relationship with Blue Coal, a company that first sponsored the program regionally in 1931, continued. It would endure for almost two decades. Announcer Ken Roberts.
The program was very successful and remained in that format for, till I think it was 1935 or so, during which time it grew from being a half-hour program to a full-hour program, which was called The Blue Coal Radio Review. The Blue Coal Radio Review was so called because our sponsor was Blue Coal. The director, the producer of the program, was a marvelous man whom all the actors in radio dearly loved, Bill Sweets. Bill was his name. In addition to producing the program, of course, he also directed the actual Shadow sequences himself. The conductor of the orchestra was George Earle, and we would have a half hour of music and then a half hour of the Shadow, and that constituted the Blue Coal Radio Review.
All the while, sales of the Shadow magazine were mounting, but readers clamored for the radio program to reflect the Shadow's magazine adventures. Street and Smith agreed, and a squabble developed between them and Blue Coal that kept the program off the air for 2 years. Finally, in 1937, Blue Coal agreed to a trial sponsorship of a series that would feature the Shadow not as host, but as the central character, and would highlight a different Shadow adventure each week over the Mutual network. Dramatic license was exercised liberally on the magazine characters, and the Shadow became Lamont Cranston, wealthy young men about town who could cloud men's minds and become invisible. Cranston's secret was shared only by his friend and companion, the lovely Margot Lane. Walter Gibson.
We began creating a whole new character. Will Cole came around, or Ruth Rock and Ryan did, and said, can we use the shadow as an announcer because we find it's a good gimmick? And so Ralston said, well, let them use the shadow, providing they say it's owned by Street and Smith and so forth and so on and so on. And the people like Blue Cole did not want to make more money out of it. In other words, they said, we'll pay for the whole thing. We're through with it with one release, that's all we want. So they gave Street and Smith a chance to take it and later reproduce it on recordings through Michelson. And Street and Smith were making money out of it and getting back the money they'd lost in the other thing. So both Nanovic and I agreed that was good because that was meant money was coming into the place and they were keeping up the magazine and he was the editor and I was the writer. But as we went along with that, the readers kept writing in. Why don't you have something about the shadow? What is this silly business about the radio program? The announcers would say it was just a gimmick. So we went to Ralston and said, we thought that they ought to take the stories from the magazine. In fact, people were saying they should. So we agreed. But the radio people wouldn't have any part of it. Oh, no, it was a great announcer. So Ralston took me along with him to see different people. And among one of the people we went to see were the Tasty East, who had a thing called the Tasty East Jesters. And we were talking about selling them. The Shadow was a dramatic show. And in that case, John and I would have been deputed to start to put this thing together and talk with their radio outfit and so forth. And they decided to stick with what they had, although they were quite interested. And that was a very interesting thing because when I went with Ralston, who treated me like I was a member of a firm, he was a wonderful person, they asked him flatly what was the circulation of the Shadow. And nobody had ever mentioned it. And he told them 300,000 an issue. Now comes the funny part. Blue Cole said, we'll pay you something for it. It's right. Street and Smith property. You control the thing, so forth. Do what you want with them. Street and Smith says, yes, but we don't want those. We want programs that have to do with the Shadow because we're going to use it to promote the Shadow magazine. And all you have to do is look at the ads in the Shadow magazine and you can see why they were saying that. And finally, Blue Cole said, we'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take it for next season. Go ahead, have all the Shadow stories. Let our script department work on them. Because we've got fellows that have been writing the kind of stuff we'll learn. And if we don't like it, we'll quit. But they said, if it's no good, can we have the Shadow back as an announcer? Well, Street and Smith, having nothing to do, said, well, we'd consider that, but let's see how it makes out. It went out and it was the hit of the year. They should have done it 3 years before, or 4 years before. And all of a sudden, everybody wanted to hear it. And the thing that made it was Lamont Cranston and the characters that they brought in. John Nanovic saw to it that enough could be gotten in. And that was its real making. And that's the program they think of now.